Oh, what? Oh, my. Where am I? Oh, my God. What? Olivia, why have you tied me to this chair?
Shut up and listen. I'm going to outline some very basic expectations. I'm going to outline some very basic expectations.
What is happening?
You're a podcaster, aren't you?
Part-time.
You're one of those little fancy men who dances in front of the microphone for an audience.
Olivia, you make the podcast with me. What's
you
happening?
You dispense ideas all over the world, don't you?
Yeah.
You're the type of guy.
Well, mostly America and Britain and Brazil, but yeah.
Is there a world beyond that?
Not that I'm aware of.
All right. Well, if you ever want to go home and see your beloved Australian flatmates and your parents' stupid dog.
No, I can't do that. I can't say that about Bonnie. She's too sweet.
Well, if you want to ever return to your cottagecore lifestyle of going to apple festivals on crisp fall days, then you're going to have to do something for me.
What?
Ow! That
I one, hate this.
That one was just because I wanted to hit you.
What did I do?
Listen here, buddy. This is how it's going to work.
Why are you getting more horse as we go on?
I am actually getting more horse. It's not a bit. Listen, I swallowed a piece of wool. It's going to kill me. I'm on my way out. The doctor said I don't have that much time left. But before I die, I need to fulfill my lifelong dream of creating a podcast episode about wool.
Yeah, you're pretty into that, aren't you? I mean, I guess if you untie me.
No, I'm sorry.
Okay, this is gonna be a long night.
The feast is all. Now brimming wine in lordly cup is seen to shine before each eager guest. And silence fills the crowded hall, as deep as when the herald's call thrills in the loyal breast.
Welcome back to the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I'm Olivia, and this is Aaron, a sheep in my flock. Very ovine, which is the word I play in Scrabble when I don't have a bee. And today we are going to be talking all about something that I can almost guarantee you I spend more time thinking about than you, and that's textiles. Medieval textiles.
I would say if about the listeners of any other podcast possibly in the world, that would be a very easy assumption to make.
Mm.
With us, I'm genuinely not sure.
Yeah, that's actually a good point.
Everybody who listens to this podcast had a Tumblr in 2013 and like had a spinning phase at the very least.
Yeah, that's fair. And today I am going to be leading you guys on an odyssey through one of my favorite things to talk about, one of my favorite materials to have, one of my favorite practices to practice, and that is textiles. Today is all about medieval textiles.
Just to give you guys some context of the vibes in here, we're in Olivia's living room. I am currently looking at one box of wool, another bag of wool, two spinning wheels over there, whatever that thing is.
That's a lazy Kate.
A lazy Kate, boy. And then three of those bolts.
Bobbins, they're bobbins.
Wait, what's a bolt then?
A bolt is like a length of cloth.
Oh, right. See, this is going to be a very uneven episode.
And you might not know it yet, but textiles are the most important thing in the world.
Yes, we were going to prove to you that textiles are the most important thing in the world, apparently.
Exactly, and
this really does feel like a hostage situation.
You were the one that said, let's do textiles. Admittedly, I think because you wanted us to have a, you know, I think after carrying Vikings, I think you were ready to put the shoe on the other foot.
Have an episode where I didn't do very much.
Well, guess what? The fleece is on the other sheep now.
Oh my God. That's as good as the puns are going to get, folks. It's only downhill from here.
And textiles might not be something that you spend much time thinking about, let alone actually engaging in the practice of creating. And I think that's, and that's a big part of why I wanted to talk about them in this episode, because this is a topic, a material, a thing that has, in my opinion, shaped an amount of human history and culture that is much, much greater than many of us often realize. And I mean, think for instance of the number of textile related references that we use in everyday speech. I mean, just planning out this episode, we would continually say things like, oh, what's the common thread?
What's the thread?
We're weaving together all of these
we're
ideas.
We're spinning a yarn.
Yeah, you're spinning a yarn, absolutely. I think, and a lot of words that aren't explicitly textile, aren't that you might not think of as being explicitly textile related, in fact are. So here's a few more. The word heckle comes from a process of extracting flax fiber from plants. Shuttle, like space shuttle or any other kind of shuttle, the original meaning of the word comes from a part of a loom. A rocket as well comes from an Italian word that means bobbin. Words like, for instance, invest or divest. What does that have in it? Vest.
Oh my god, is that really a thing?
Yes, because fabric and clothing and fashion have an absolutely massive amount of social power and social weight, and so to don the garments of power or to bestow the garments of power or the clothing of power.
Investiture.
Exactly.
And plus, they won't let you into the stock exchange unless you're wearing a particular fine vest.
Yeah, so when you invest in something, you are literally donning it as clothes, and then you are, when you divest, you are taking off those clothes.
It's getting late. I'm going to invest in some pajamas.
Exactly. I mean, the word text is a fabric-related word, because it comes from the word textile.
Textiles. Wow. Why?
Because a text is a weaving of words. Like, it is a tapestry of words. That is the literal, that is the origin of the word text. And so I think that we think of, and I mean especially with regards to storytelling and narratives, textiles often feel like they are an amazing metaphor for this sort of active genesis, because you can spin a yarn, can't you, as well?
Weave a story.
Yes. The word clue as well. I don't know if you saw that I tweeted about that, actually.
I don't read your Twitter.
Oh, this is really interesting. This is one of my favorite ones, the origin of the word clue. So clue originally was a word that meant a ball of yarn. And it was spelled C-L-E-W. And it's a word that etymologically is related, I believe, to words like cluster. So it was a word whose initial sense had to do with, like, wrapping or mixing or sort of like, you know, I don't know, agglomerating things together, and then took on a more specific meaning of ball of yarn in the Middle Ages. And through association with the myth of Theseus, Theseus having been given a literal clue from Ariadne as to how to get out of the labyrinth, this extremely evocative image of a thread being used to guide him out eventually was what gave the word its current meaning. Last few word ones, because okay, I think these okay, are okay. so
these
much
These are fun.
Fun.
I like these.
They are really fun.
In fact, you know, I'm going to gamify it. You're going to give me a word, and I'm going to try and guess what the etymological relationship is.
Actually, I have one that's explicitly a textile word, but okay. Your job, I don't know if I've told you this one before, but if I haven't, your job will be to guess what the etymology of this word is.
Okay, hit me.
It's the word robe.
Can you give me a clue? No pun intended.
You shouldn't be trying to extend it. You should be trying to shorten it.
Row?
No.
Obe?
No.
Ob?
No.
O?
No.
B?
No.
I can't shorten anymore.
The word robe only contains one, like, other word within it without rearranging any of the letters.
B.
Oh, actually, two.
What is that?
It's Rob! I'm sorry, I didn't think it would... No, no, sorry. I was going to say, I didn't think it would take you that long to get it.
No, keep that in.
No, so the word robe, as in the garment, literally comes from the French word robe, which meant to steal, because clothes were so precious and so valuable that they were one of the most frequently stolen items. And that's why you have, for instance, a wardrobe or a garderobe.
Because you gotta guard your robes.
Or ward them.
Wow.
And so, and people's surnames as well, especially in the Middle Ages, which I think we can generally agree is the genesis of the surname in the way that we think of it today. A lot of people had occupational surnames, so surnames Cooper. That related to the job they do. Cooper makes, I think, hoops for barrels, mm-hmm. which is, yeah, probably not monotonous.
Not to be confused with Hooper, which means somebody who's very good at basketball.
And so you have surnames such as Weber is a weaver, of course, and you have surnames. You've got Fuller is someone who works with fabric, Draper, Taylor, of course, Mercer. And interestingly, Middle English preserved to an extent the Old English construction of having a feminine gendered suffix in the form of anything that ended in S-T-E-R would be a feminine occupation. So Webster. Spinster is therefore an explicitly female spinner, and a Webster is a female weaver. Dexter wow. is a female dyer, someone who dyes fabric, not who kicks the bucket. That would be the milkmaid. Well, that would be the cow, actually.
I was like, the milk... Pretty shitty milkmaid.
So, and I think that's an interesting etymological construct as well, because you've got words like Baxter was a female baker, Sangster, a female singer. So the words occupational surnames give us a really interesting look into what kinds of jobs women had in the Middle Ages. And in a lot of folklore and art, you often see textiles as a motif. So thinking back as far as the ancient Greeks, you have instances like the three fates, the Moirai, three women who literally spin, measure out, and cut the thread of your life. So the textile, the fiber, is life.
A motif that reoccurs suspiciously similarly in Norse mythology as well. The Norns. The Norns are essentially a more sort of sinister version of the fates. But again, it's women.
Yep.
Women definitely do control my fate. Truth in mythology, once again.
And in the Iliad, you have the wife of Odysseus, Penelope, who is depicted as faithfully waiting at home for her husband. And in order to stave off all of these unwanted requests of marriage, so that she doesn't have to capitulate to them, she says that she is weaving, I believe it's her marriage veil. And that she won't marry until she finishes this piece of weaving.
Sorry, so, boys, I'm busy. Come back tomorrow.
And so every day she weaves and every night she unpicks what she wove so that she never has to remarry. In fact, in the Odyssey as well, Helen of Troy is depicted as spinning with a golden spindle. And this isn't just folklore, actually. This is something that we know. These are golden spindles made of gold or objects that we know for a fact that ancient Greek women would give to each other.
I'm putting my hand up, breaking the fourth wall for a second here. Explain to our audience what a spindle is. Because it is not necessary. Most people who listen to this podcast will have only encountered it in the context of folklore. So What does a spindle do?
So a spindle is essentially just a stick. It's a stick that you use to twist fibers, often wool, or plant fibers like cotton or linen, into thread. So it's the oldest and most sort of fundamental tool of textile making. This is something that we know for a fact actually happened in real life as well, that ancient Greek women of the nobility would give each other golden spindles as ceremonial gifts, and they would use them. They would spin them. They would make extremely elaborate textiles, luxurious fabrics with them.
Well, most of them would probably go on a shelf. I'm not saying they wouldn't use the golden spindles. I'm saying after a certain point, you'd have too many golden spindles.
No. Okay.
Okay.
Actually, in fact, it's time to back up a little bit. Because Aaron unknowingly has alluded to a very good point. And before I continue any further, this will be a bit stream of consciousness.
All the points that I make are unknowing.
Before I go any further, I want to talk about a spiritual debt that this episode owes to a very interesting book called Women's Work, The First 20,000 Years by...
Dolly Parton.
Nah, Kate Bush. Kate Bush, come on. By Elizabeth Wayland Barber, who's an archaeologist. So this book is a few decades old, and I definitely think that it's due like a much needed revisit with more recent and rigorous scholarly methods, but it's an amazing archaeological look at the evidence that we have of textile making specifically as women's work. And one of the things that Elizabeth Wayland Barber gets at right from the outset of this book is how important she thinks it is to explore these things as well in the context of practical and experimental archaeology. And so she opens the book with a description of her trying to weave a piece of cloth that was found on an archaeological dig. And she stresses the importance of this type of experience because people who don't know on like a fundamental mechanical level how these things work will always be at a disadvantage for trying to interpret them in a historical context. Like, that might sound very reductive, but actually you would be surprised for how long historians have given very confident sounding discourses on all sorts of things that they have no idea.
Well, if I may, another example that unfortunately I can't remember what the example is that Joe Mason told me is of a certain kind of cooking tool that we only know, or it's a certain kind of a domestic tool that we only know about. We only know how it worked because an archaeologist tried to use one in the manner in which it was assumed they were used and, like, slashed his arm open immediately.
Yeah, exactly. And so spindles, as anyone who spins would know, you can never have enough of them because they can only hold so much wool. And you might be working, and once you want to actually use what you've spun on them or... then you'll need to either put it on a loom or you'll need to wind it off somewhere else. So it's really convenient to be able to put down one spindle and just pick up another one. And most historical evidence suggests that people who spun had a lot of spindles. And I don't think there's any reason to doubt that women who were given lots of fancy spindles would have had use for them as well.
Best me told.
Although Elizabeth Wayland Barber doesn't talk at all about the Middle Ages in this book, the first 20,000 years encompasses, by her estimation, a period of time that ends with ancient Rome. I think it's a really good book for understanding the historical origins of textiles and the conception of textiles as women's work. Because this is an association that's existed for as long as we've had evidence of textile manufacture. Because there are archaeological finds where women's skeletons showed patterns of wear that were unique to people who would be using the types of looms and types of textile making equipment that they had at the time. And Elizabeth Wayland Barber's sort of case for why this association between textiles and women took shape is simply to do with the different expectations that befall someone who raises children. Because if you have a baby at home, well, first of all, you don't want to be going out and carrying that baby all over the place. And second of all, children are erratic. They are often very low in reserves of self-preservation instincts. They make a lot of noise. They need constant attention. And so...
make a lot of bad decisions.
Yes, exactly. And so spinning and weaving are things that are as essential for the family more or less, as finding food, but they're things that can be done very easily with equipment that does not break very easily. They're things that can be put down at a moment's notice. They don't require a massive amount of concentration. You can be rocking the baby with your foot while you work on something else. And so, of course, although that is largely conjecture, it is still absolutely the case that we do have this really long-standing association with spinning and weaving in particular as being the sort of quintessential domestic arts for women at all levels of society. And so often we have information about these in reference to them being these quintessential domestic arts, things that are symbolic of being a model woman and a model wife and a model homemaker. So Penelope is shown as being diligent and faithful because she's willing to work at this continual, repetitive, ostensibly very boring task. Ancient Roman women as well would often boast about their skill in spinning. Julius Caesar's wife talked about how good of a spinner she was. We have examples of graves in ancient Rome of women that have inscriptions that say she was a good spinner, which I think on one hand you could say, well, that's a bit sad that a woman's life would be reduced down to that. But to the extent that this was set as the, you know, benchmark for what defined a good woman and a virtuous woman, this was actually an extremely favorable compliment.
And if I might state the obvious here, these are women, especially the ones you're talking about right now, who don't have to know how that works and don't have to do it because they are wealthy women who live in a urbanized society. They could just buy it. The fact that they know how to do it and boast about it suggests that it is, as you say, a normative thing.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I think the fact that we have a lot of evidence that women would partake in these activities, even wealthy women, and that wealthy women would still do them, but in this ritualized way of using your golden spindle and perhaps making an elaborate piece of, you know, patterned silk fabric or something. I think it very much goes to show, and I think this is another part of textile history that makes it so relevant and so interesting, is it shows that it's a very broad-reaching reference point, that it was something that women from all levels of society were held to, and that something that women were held to for tens of thousands of years.
Performing the symbols of femininity.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Interestingly, though, not all representations of women engaging in these practices were positive. In fact, textiles weren't just used as a way to show how diligent and responsible a woman was. They appeared in all sorts of contexts. So I have there's actually a really good example from Norse mythology. I don't know if you've come across this particular source before.
Hit me.
Here is a poem from an Icelandic saga.
Love an Icelandic saga.
Everyone likes an Icelandic saga. This is one about the Battle of Clontarf in Ireland that took place in the 11th century. And it's about Valkyries.
Blood rains from the cloudy web on the broad loom of slaughter. The web of man, gray as armor, is now being woven. The Valkyries will cross it with a crimson weft. The warp is made of human entrails. Human heads are used as hedge weights. The heddle rods are blood-wet spears. The shafts are iron-bound, and arrows are the shuttles. With swords we will weave this web of battle.
It's very unpleasant.
It's quite gnarly, though, isn't it? And I think even if you don't know what all of that technical loom vocabulary actually means, and I won't go into it, I think it's still an unbelievably evocative image, isn't it? I mean, they're weaving a tapestry with swords and guts, and there's human heads hanging from the loom, and the parts of the loom are like spears and arrows and weapons of war, and it's all just like dripping with blood.
It's the kind of stuff you probably couldn't even put in most horror movies.
Yeah.
It's viscerally. Oh. It's visceral. Literally.
Yes. So
this is when I said in the Norse mythology episode the Valkyries aren't sexy. This is the kind of thing I was talking about. They're very upsetting.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They're frightening. And this type of negative and more destructive, and despite the fact that, especially in the Middle Ages, women engaging in textile arts was seen as something that was good, it was generative, it was, you know, displayed diligence, often they preserved this metaphor of, you know, thread being spun, being akin to a life. Virgin Mary is often shown as spinning while she's pregnant with Jesus, the metaphor being that she is spinning the thread of his life. There are also negative associations with it. So that poem with the Valkyries is a great example of one.
Well, I mean, the Valkyrie poem is interesting because it's still women doing the spinning. But yeah. Because they're very upsetting women, they're doing very upsetting spinning.
Yes. And so this is something that's really important to draw out, is that in a lot of ways, especially in the Middle Ages, although there was this archetypal image of a woman at her spinning or at her weaving, at her women's work, these types of practices were also almost like a mirror of the woman herself. Like, it's not that spinning is good, but it is in a good woman, it is a manifestation of that goodness. Whereas, of course, a really scary woman would be doing it, but in a really scary way.
But yeah, it just means woman.
Yeah, exactly. So in, I believe, some Anglo-Saxon stories, women who partake in unifying marriages of peace are often referred to as peace weavers.
Love a good kenning.
Yeah. So the associations are absolutely all over the place. On the Norman, think of Roland. There is his Gerlam, who dies on the field.
Why then is there such a strong association between femininity and, like, textile manufacturing? I mean, you've already mentioned a couple, like, this is the kind of work, the thesis that this is the kind of work that a woman could do at home. And then there's also something as well that you've kind of touched on about the, like, the making of things being a generative act and creation being associated with the creation of life. But is there a sort of unifying theme here?
I mean, as you just said, these are things that could be done at the home. And in general, the medieval conception of gender roles is very clear about where women belong. Yeah, in fact, medieval society, very explicitly, because we have advice books and poems that wrote about this, would say a virtuous thing for a woman is to be at home and to work. And this was often tied up in conceptions of maintaining these roles that the genders had that were given by God, and maintaining a sense of purity around these roles. So I read a really interesting paper, which I partially agreed with, partially disagreed with, about male and female spaces in the Middle Ages. One of the things I agreed with was that there was a conception that the feminine space was the familiar, it was at home, it was maybe your village or your quarter of the city, but that it would be extremely inappropriate for a woman to go beyond the boundaries of these so-called feminine spaces.
If I may come in here with a general, just general historian's point, the thesis of the general arguments about female and male spheres are all well and good to talk about, but pretty consistently throughout history, that gets harder and harder to police the lower down the social stratum you go. And so you do tend to see just in pretty much every era of history where there are these very strict ideas about male and female spaces, you do just see less practical enforcement of that among working class people because somebody's got to muck out the goddamn pigs.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And I think the things, domestic work and domestic labor, are things for which we will always have both very little in the way of archaeological evidence and textual mm-hmm. evidence.
But we can infer from, like, even in the modern era, you know.
What I mean to say is that just because people were writing about these things didn't mean they were being stuck to, you know, religiously. But I think in terms of how a narrative was formed around what women should be doing, these ideas are very important. I mean, mm-hmm. for instance, in the trial of Joan of Arc, they asked Joan about how much time she spent in the fields and whether she spent any of her time herding sheep. And she refuted that she did. She said, no, I would stay at home doing my spinning. And so that was clearly something that was important for them mm-hmm. to try to draw out, because it was seen as, you know, where a woman spent her time was seen as something that very much characterized that woman.
The thing that screwed Joan of Arc, whether it was her going out to the fields or the fairy tree, is just that an official Orthodox lens is applied to folk culture, it usually finds it wanting.
Well, yeah, I think we talked about that quite a bit in our episode about witches and priests who, you know, find people's linens using trickery in exchange for sexual favors.
Medieval wizard Poirot.
Exactly. And more importantly, like, an extension of this framework, which was, of course, not always broadly adhered to, you know, completely adhered to in real life, was the idea that if a woman needed to go out into the world beyond, so the so-called masculine space, there were correct ways that she should behave herself in order to maintain her separation from it. And so, for instance, like, if you're going out into the fields, you should have a man with you. If you're traveling, you should be traveling for the right reasons and have a man with you. If you have to go out into the city, then you should not make eye contact with anyone and don't talk to anyone and just do your business and go home. Don't go to the pub. Don't go to the pub. A lot of these advice books are very specific about whether women should go to the pub, and the answer is usually no.
And my eyebrow is raising again, because one of the good rules of thumb that you can use as a historian is that if something is explicitly prohibited, it was definitely happening.
Oh, yeah. Here's a good poem, a 15th century English poem called How the Good Wife Taught Her Daughter. Here's a stanza from it. Go not to the wrestling or shooting at the cock, as it were a strumpet or a gigolot. Dwell at home, daughter, and love thy work much. And thou shalt, my dear child, wax the sooner rich. A merry thing to sever more, a man to be served of his own store. And then she also says,
how's she going to find a man if she doesn't go where all the men are?
So yeah, there's, and this poem repeats all this advice, like, you know, don't make small talk with a man. Don't, you know, like, yeah, don't make eye contact with a man is a big one. She says, if you go to a place where good ale is served, presumably in contrast to somewhere where bad ale is served, then you should just partake of a small, sort of modest amount. Don't
have
get
a
drunk.
Half pint.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
a dainty.
So, and again, this was not about what, you know, I think it's safe to say that this was not something that women were conforming to universally in real life, but it was a framework for how a woman could conform to societal standards of virtue.
Yeah, because just because these were things that were happening doesn't mean you wouldn't get judged for it.
Exactly.
And that's the great tension of we live in a society, is that you can do things even if you know they're probably bad.
Well, yeah, and whether or not women were actually in danger when they would say, if they would say go to from town to town with no chaperone, which, I mean, they probably were. But regardless of mm-hmm. that, I think that conforming to these expectations was a way for a woman to demonstrate that she was aware of what the standards were and to signal her desire to conform to them, Like, that's what makes, for instance, a prostitute scary to someone in the Middle Ages, is not that she's someone, not just that she's someone who doesn't conform, but that she is someone who has ostensibly chosen a life of nonconformity and must, you know, carry the marks of that evermore. Prostitutes, they spun as well. There were depictions in ancient Rome of prostitutes spinning their wool in between clients. So, yeah.
Gotta get on that grind set.
Yeah.
Multiple sources of income.
No, exactly.
Diversify your portfolio.
Yeah. And I mean, I think one thing that I sort of took issue with in this paper was this idea of entirely distinct women's and men's spaces, because a man's space, a masculine space in this framework, ostensibly is somewhere that is characterized by the absence of women, but a feminine space is somewhere ostensibly that is characterized by the presence of a man.
Yeah.
Because if you're a single woman and you've never married, your home is not seen in the Middle Ages as a feminine space.
Mm.
You're seen as a freak. Like, you are violating, again, these expectations for how to show that you want to be part of society.
Which it seems very unfair on us men, may I say, because we can't be everywhere at once. We can't be at the wrestling end at home.
You gig a lot.
We're famously bad at multitasking.
Yeah. Yeah, being someone who was a very diligent spinner or weaver, especially spinner, because the equipment for it was just available to more people. You know, spindles are literally just sticks. They're cheap. A woman in my spinning guild famously likes to say that you can make one. She actually says the classic spindle is a chopstick and a potato, which is not true. That's not the classic spindle.
You know, those classic spindles we all know.
You know, in ancient medieval manuscripts, they've always got the chopstick and the potato.
The two things that they had an abundance of in Europe before the 16th century. Potatoes and chopsticks.
Oh, potatoes.
Toes and chopsticks. Potatoes and chopsticks. Seasonal references.
Yeah. So I think that's, yeah.
This is our most cottagecore episode yet.
It is very cottagecore, actually. So yeah, it's productive. It keeps you at home. It keeps you, you know, out of trouble. And I think there's also, this is my own conjecture at play, but I would argue that there is also an element of spinning in particular being very simple, very simple menial work. It's repetitive. It doesn't require you really to think at all about it. And I think that was seen as something that was good for women.
Well, okay. I would half agree with you there. I think because I think that I agree with you to an extent, but I think there's a missing element, which is that it's menial and repetitive, but also requires minimal physical strength. Because there's lots of forms of physical activity in the Middle Ages. Just when you have to do everything with your hands, most work is menial, but most menial work is backbreaking labor.
Yes.
And so this is a form of menial work that a dainty peasant girl can do without, you know, getting big abs.
Yeah. Have you seen how beefy my fingers are?
Oh my god. Check out those yams.
Yeah. And I think in some ways it was, you know, women might feel a little bit of resentment about that. In some ways, spinning could also be seen as something that was hard work or something that was, you know, an unasked for obligation, which of course isn't all of life just unasked for obligations. So for instance, your friend and mine, Christine de Pizan, writes in her City of Ladies book that her father wished her to be educated, but her mother wished her to stay at home and spin and do other silly woman things. So I think
she's such a 19th century character.
I know.
That's the thing that I find fascinating about her. She's like 300 years early, basically.
Yeah.
She's 400 years early.
Yeah, she is. She is.
She would have been busting it up with like the Unitarians. She would have had a fantastic 100%. Time.
And of course, you know, she, in typical Christine de Pizan fashion, she plays on this motif very cleverly. In another book, she says, she's writing about war, and she says, of course, a woman like me, you know, would be much more at home talking about things like, you know, spinning and weaving and whatnot than about war. But anyways, let's talk about the goddess Minerva.
Well, that is clever because it's like, women shouldn't be involved in war. Well, here's a woman who loves war.
And textiles.
Oh, yeah.
Because Minerva is the goddess of spinning and weaving.
Man.
In fact, one of the really good archaeological finds that Elizabeth Wayland Barber talks about in her book is loom weights, which are basically these just like, I don't know, palm-sized lead weights that depict an owl with arms spinning. And they're really cute.
And was that owl hench? No.
I think crucially, this idea of spinning being something that silly women do is another important lens through which we can look at how people, especially in the Middle Ages, perceived this, because it was very much a double-edged sword, as most swords are. Not katanas, I guess. No, maybe they are.
Scimitars.
Scimitars, definitely. Anyways.
Swords aren't double-edged. It's fine. Huh? You wouldn't know about that.
You're right, because I'm a woman.
Because you're a silly woman.
I've never held a sword before, just like you've never held a spindle.
Have you back? Is that a joke? Please tell me you've held a sword before.
I've opened a beer with a sword. Yeah. The good wife would not be happy about that.
Beer and swords.
And so, I think to an extent it's a bit of a chicken or an egg thing if people thought of spinning as being silly because women did it. Or if, you know, that you know, probably it's less that people thought women were silly because they spun and more thought spinning was silly because women do it and women are just so silly and stupid.
I'm just a girl.
Exactly. But we do have a lot of evidence of negative associations with it as well. I mean, spinster is not like a good thing to be. Spinning a yarn is like making something up, which comes from a strong medieval association between spinning and gossip. So a bunch of, you know, one woman is sitting at home alone spinning is like, okay, but clearly two women sitting together spinning, like they're cooking up trouble. People didn't like that. And you have a lot of images in medieval manuscripts, marginalia, of women using their spindles and their distaffs, a distaff essentially just being like a stick that's maybe like a couple meters long that you tie your wool to so you can carry your unspun wool around. And so there's a lot of imagery of women using these like as weapons, like beating their husbands over the head with them. There's like women jousting with them where they're holding a distaff instead of a lance. There are women who ride their distaffs like they're witches' broomsticks. There's women in Germanic imagery as well who spin storms with their spindles.
Again, the association of textiles with creation.
Yes. And so it's clear that there was also an element of female frivolity that played into this. There's a play, a medieval play that's a dramatization of the Noah's Ark story, in which Noah's wife won't get on the ark until she finishes her spinning. And he's like, hey, babe, it's flooding. And she's like, wait, I need to finish my spinning.
Wives, am I right?
Exactly. And so it's almost like these stories are these cautionary tales of why we should, you know, not let women do anything, even the most simple menial thing, unsupervised.
Because they'll get too into it.
Yeah, exactly. And another, there's a quote from one of our other faves, Chaucer's Wife of Bath.
Yes.
Who has a quote that I think...
The first recorded MILF.
She's got a quote that I think sums up the attitudes very well. She says, "Deceit, weeping, and spinning does God give to women naturally while they live." So women are good at three things.
Being sad, lying, and textile manufacture.
Yep. I think that sums up most of my hobbies, right? At least the ones I'm good at.
Yeah, I mean, she was talking about you. Yeah. Specifically, just to be clear. You didn't provide that context.
Well, being a writer is about being sad. Being a podcaster is about lying. And
look at all this
spinning
wool.
Is about spinning. Yeah. Yeah. So it's a... Yeah, it's a very sort of rich, metaphorical, symbolic field. Very fertile, symbolic ground, I should say.
So up until this point in the episode, we have been talking about spinning and textile manufacturing as women's work, as things that women do. And that's interesting that we did that, because if you believed us, then you've fallen for one of the classic blunders, which is believing the things that we say on this show to be true.
One of the other ones is staging a land invasion of Russia in the winter.
All right, Reddit.
What? That's literally the Princess Bride. It long predates Reddit.
So yeah, so we've been lying. Men did this too. So, I mean, while spinning has a kind of cultural cachet that's associated with women and femininity, there's a lot more to textile manufacturing than just spinning. Why don't you give them a sort of brief summary of all the things that are involved in just wool manufacturing alone? Because that is your specialist subject.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, first of all, it's important to note that men absolutely did spin wool. Per Elizabeth Whalen Barber, in ancient Rome at least, everyone who was not a man of the nobility would spin wool. So that included, you know, just your average day Joe Schmo, or whatever he would be called.
Joe Schmoes.
Claudius Schmadius. But yeah, of all of the stages, so textile manufacture. Believe me when I tell you that it is labor intensive. We were just discussing this at my guild today.
Yes, and I was there.
Yes, and someone was estimating that for any given garment, it would take, in terms of purely the labor involved, a minimum of 100 hours from, as she said, the sheep's back to your back.
That's a great turn of phrase. I like that.
So, of course, someone has to actually find that sheep and shear it. Someone's got to take all of that disgusting wool, because sheep are disgusting, and clean it. Aww. And they're not hygienic animals, in fact.
Doesn't mean you have to be pejorative about it.
Once you've washed a raw sheep's fleece right off the sheep...
You think I haven't handled sheep's?
No, trust me, trying to actually wash it makes you get acquainted with, like, what sheep pick up and carry in their fleeces, and... I don't like it.
It's bugs.
Bugs, poop, dirt, yeah. Indeterminate things. a lot of bugs. I'm sorry, bugs is gross. Like,
nah, bugs are cool. Bugs are my friend.
But they are gross.
That's neither here nor there.
Well, anyways, I'm sure that, you know, people who worked in cleaning raw wool, like the Chompy, felt really good about their place in life. Anyways, you have to clean off all of that wool, optionally. You can also just spin it in the grease, as it's called, ugh, which is more or less what it sounds like. And then the wool has to be combed or carded, so it basically has to be, like, brushed out nicely. And then it can be spun. After spinning, it will be woven on a loom. After that, you've got your piece of cloth. So what do? You take that and sew with it. Ah, you thought. So first, you're probably going to dye it at this stage in the process. And that's possibly going to be like a multi-stage process.
You gotta get a lot of snails.
Gotta get a lot of snails. Or maybe you have to, like, you know, do one color on top of another. Because there's no natural green dye. And then after that, it's probably going to undergo a process known as fulling or walking or something else, depending on where you live in the world, where you basically, like, felt it. Like, when you put a wool jumper in the wash and it shrinks, that's actually quite a desirable thing to do to cloth because it will make it a lot more durable. And then you're probably going to raise a nap on it. You're going to take like a brush and brush it, like a wire brush, and brush it over the surface of the fabric to even it out, to make it really fuzzy. And then you will go over that and shear that fuzz down to make it uniform and get it to your desired thickness. And then you can cut it up and sew it into a garment. So yeah, no wonder people were worried about their clothes getting taken off them, right? Like, that's a lot of work.
That sounds nice and easy to me. So that's a lot of stages, but it doesn't tell us a lot about who is responsible for doing all those stages. So my first question to you is, did everyone in the Middle Ages do all those stages themselves?
I think anyone who lived rurally very likely would have been involved in those stages. I don't think everyone necessarily was involved in all of them because, for instance, a loom to weave on is expensive. So you might spin and then send it off and pay to have your yarn woven. But I do think it's fair to say that outside of the aristocracy, essentially anyone could be doing that, including people who were employed. And so this was both something that people might do at a subsistence level. You might spin or weave or sew for your family, but it was also very much something you could do on the side. Like, this was a side gig as well. Spinning was a very, very common side gig.
Like podcasting.
Exactly. Except they got paid for it. We spin proverbial yarns.
We spin proverbial yarns for our own edification,
for
apparently.
Proverbial money.
Okay, so most people make most of their own clothes, I think is a fair summary of that. But, of course, not everybody is going to be able to make high-end clothes. And if there's one thing that rich people love, it's high-end clothes. So what do you do if you want to have a very nice robe or a very nice hat?
Well, first of all, you've got to have the nicest materials. So mm-hmm. In the Middle Ages, there were specific breeds of sheep. I think Cotswold sheep were considered to be very nice, and sheep in Lincolnshire mm-hmm. were also renowned. Sheep from Cornwall were like, bad, boo. If you live in Cornwall, you probably wear really crap clothes made from your crap sheep. So that's one important thing. Or you might have something fancy and imported like silk. Oh my gosh, silk. Silkworms cannot live in the UK or Northern Europe. They hate it here and they starve for our lack of mulberry trees, which is the only thing that they eat. So you'd be very posh indeed if you had silk garments. And of course you would want maybe a very fine weave, and so you would be paying someone to spin very, very fine threads, which would take more time to spin, and more time to, of course, make the fabric on the loom as well. And then, of course, there's the dyeing. So color, I think, is what people often think of when they think of gatekeeping clothes in the past. There's a lot of information we have about so-called sumptuary laws, where people were banned from wearing specific colors or specific materials because it would have been seen as very much aspirational to, you know, it would have been seen as uppity, I guess, or presumptuous. And so, in particular, although it's not true, as people stereotype it, that medieval peasants would have exclusively worn, like, you know, the dullest colors possible and like only gray and brown, there are very much colors that are difficult to get, that are multi-stage processes. A really bright red is very, very hard to get. Purple, of course, is the classic example. Mostly
hitting a lot of snails with a mallet.
Snails or lichen.
Blame the Phoenicians.
So actually, if you lived in Scotland, I think there's a decent chance you could have had some sweet purple digs because lichen grows very abundantly.
And when you're on a trading mission to I don't know, like Gothenburg or something, it's like, oh, is that authentic real snail purple? You'd be like, yes.
Well, that was one of the motivations for Spain colonizing the Canary Islands was the preponderance of purple pigment bearing lichen.
To put a slightly finer point on it, The upshot of this is that it's harder and more expensive to make things that are better. This is a this is a basic bit of economics.
Yeah.
And so ordinary people who have other stuff that they need to do are probably not going to do all of this. And also, to do this stuff to a very high standard is going to require a certain level of specialization. If you want the finest purple robe, you're going to want to get somebody to dye it who only thinks about dying.
Absolutely, and probably someone who only thinks about dyeing purple. Like, the level of specialization that people can attain is impressive, especially when the stakes are very high, because having already, you know, described the amount of work it takes just to get to the dying phase, you don't want to screw up at that point, do you? Then you're really in the hole.
And so these like two kind of basic laws of economics have a cascading effect that lead to two main things, if I may. Number one, it means that the production of high-end clothes is a supply chain. We talked about this over a year ago.
Yikes!
In the Florence episode, but to recap this very briefly, every state in a major sort of wool manufacturing center like Florence, every stage of that process is handled by a different person. So there's a very good chance that wool is being imported from somewhere like England. Got that good fancy Cotswold wool.
Yes.
Then it's being transported, you know, via the ports in the Netherlands and Flanders.
The Low Countries.
Then you're going to have people who are just wool carders, who card wool every day.
There's Fuller. So Fuller, yes, was really important. The guy who, like, pounded your wool to make it, like, felt together. That was, like, one of the most important stages.
The important thing to remember about this is that supply chains are decentralized. They're not vertically integrated. Vertically integrated means, again, that, like, there's a controlling mind behind all the sort of chain, the steps in the chain, and that one company handles, you know, the collection of the wool and then also the refining and manufacture. This is a bunch of middlemen stacked upon one another, and each of these middlemen has their own, in most cases, has their own guild. Not the workers, just to be clear. If you're a wool carder, you don't go to guild. They were very clear about that. Only certain professions could have guilds. But point being that every stage of the process, there's a different guy who you have to negotiate, yes, with.
Absolutely.
Which drives the price up more.
Yes, yes. And I think it's so funny, as an aside, that, like, one of the main reasons why the Middle Ages had this complete... For a lot of the Middle Ages, there was a lack of these vertically integrated supply chains was because, like, bookkeeping technology or, like, knowledge had not evolved to that point. Like,
you couldn't have those economies of scale that you would need to manage that process.
Yeah, like, there was just accounting did not exist in the sense we think of it today. Like, you would maybe have, like, you just have, like, a bag of money and you just, like, count out your money.
Yeah, the Florentines came up with it. And just, like, instantly revolutionized. That's how they won. They were like, you know, you should write some of this stuff down.
Yeah.
So that's the first kind of effect of these economic principles, is these creation of these supply chains of multiple parties. The second one is urbanization. Because, as we just talked about, you don't have the economy of scale to manage a complex supply chain from beginning to end. What that means is, you know... The wonderful world that we live in, right, of endless Microsoft Teams meetings, means that you can very plausibly hire somebody who does not work to work for you, who does not work in the same city that you do, or even the same continent, if you want to get really freaky. What that means is that you have the technology of, again, to use Microsoft Teams as an example, allows you to monitor their output in real time and make sure that things happen the way they're supposed to. In the Middle Ages, that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Because you don't have double account bookkeeping, and you don't have, like, easy long-distance communication, which means that you can't run a company effectively over that level of, like, over a large distance, which means that it's very helpful if economic activity is all in one place. you want to check if your supplier is going to deliver you the number of bolts of fabric he told you he would, you run down the street and you say, how are things in the workshop?
Yep.
You can't do that if your supplier, or it's hard to do that if your supplier is 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 towns away.
Yeah.
So the fabric industry has this kind of centrifugal effect where economic activity gets more and more concentrated. And that, in a sort of weird irony, then bounces back and creates more demand for exactly the same kind of luxury good that that supply chain system created.
Yes, absolutely. And fabric is also, I think, it really was the commodity of the Middle Ages, especially in, you know, it was the domestic product of certainly England and a lot of other countries in Western Europe, because of course they could import spices and those were highly sought after. But fabric has specific qualities that make it very good as a commodity. Well, first of all, in addition to the fact that fabric and clothing make for a very useful form of conspicuous consumption, so to speak, the idea of buying and consuming something to display your real or desired social status. So in short, by having more clothes and nicer clothes, you could make yourself look super cool to your friends.
Or you could buy a gigantic yellow monster truck like that guy from Better Call Saul.
Exactly. But I think the second part of this is that in relation to things that the average person, types of productive labor that the average person can take part in, say, in comparison to agricultural labor and its fruits, literally.
I was about to say.
Fabric is much, much easier to buy and sell. If you grow, like, you know, extra apples at your farm, then, like, the value of those apples is going to be limited by how long you can store them for, how difficult it is for your neighbor who you're trying to sell them to grow their own apples, being able to find a market essentially for those things and get a good price for them. Whereas something like fabric, or specifically for fabric, garments and fabric can be kept indefinitely. They're very efficient to transport, especially if you think of it in terms of a cost to weight ratio, like one apple versus an equal weight of fabric. The value of the fabric is going to be much, much higher, probably because the apple is like 99% water.
And also because, to be really blunt, apples, it's okay if fabric is transported slowly.
Yeah, exactly.
It is not okay if an apple is transported slowly.
And you can throw fabric around. The throwing fabric around will not decrease the price in the same way that, like, throwing an apple against the wall will probably knock off a few pence at least from what you can get for that apple. And then in comparison to other, like, luxury commodities, say jewelry, the materials that you need to make fabric are very widespread and relatively cheap compared to, you know, say gold or gems. And the materials you need to process them are also widespread and cheap.
Yeah, the expensive part's the labor.
The expensive part is the labor. So the raw materials, if you want to make, say, a diamond ring, actually they didn't do that in the Middle Ages, they couldn't cut diamonds yet.
If you wanted to tie a gigantic rock to a ring and then offer it to your wife,
she would be like, "What the fuck, babe?"
You put it on her hand and she'd just like fall to the ground immediately.
Ah, the old ball and chain.
That's staying in.
Actually, you know what? The raw materials for the ring are going to cost you a lot more than the raw materials for the fabric.
And you're also, at the other end of it, going to need a lot of expensive labor for that as well.
Yeah, but it will take fewer hours to make the gold ring than it will to make the dress. But, and only one person can make the ring. Whereas, like, again, making a bolt of fabric, it's like dozens of people spending weeks of time.
Mm-hmm. And the important thing to remember about all of these, speaking of all these people, is that most of the people engaged in this supply chain, the dyers, the carders, the fullers, those are, whilst spinning might have been mostly women, probably, those are almost exclusively male professions. Because they are professions. They're not something that you can do in the home. They're not domestic labor. You want to put a dyeing pit in your living room? Okay, man.
Those things absolutely stink. I don't even want to talk about some of the smells I've smelt while dying. This is the thing, is people think that if you die with plants like natural dyeing, it's like making, it's like the equivalent of like making tea.
Yeah.
Like, well, let me just say this. One of the most commonly used chemicals in dyeing before the age of synthetic dyes was piss.
Oh, yeah.
You would just, like, have vats and vats of piss. And it sucked. It would not be fun. There's a fun fact, actually, is that ancient Romans would put out, like, chamber pots on their front steps so anyone who was passing by and needed a piss could, like, donate it.
Well, this piss is don't want to go to waste.
Well, yeah, looms for weaving are expensive. Fulling, which is this felting process, takes place by the High Middle Ages in these massive water-powered mills with these big pounding hammers that will eventually be adapted into paper mills. And again, like, I cannot reiterate enough that, like, men were spinning. We have the hard evidence that men were spinning.
But women are also doing it.
Women are also doing it. But I think, interestingly, like, it's more often with men that we see it listed as a job. I think, like, you know, making it going pro, essentially, like, as a woman, it would be, like, antithetical to, like, what a woman's supposed to be. Like, she's not supposed to have a business sense, you know? She's not supposed to, like, talk to people.
Those two factors of urbanization and supply chains made it inevitable that those were going to be male-dominated fields, because they require you to enter spaces that are traditionally the domain of men, which is cities.
Yes.
And the outside of your own home. You know, you can, you know, a man might be spinning in his own home, but he's not occupying a male space while he does it. He is simply a man at home.
Yeah.
Whereas a woman going into a male space, as we've alluded to earlier, that's dangerous and weird. And you're probably a prostitute if you do it.
Yeah. Because I think there's a whole kind of, I don't know, almost spectrum of work and, like, ways of work and lifestyles, working lifestyles in the Middle Ages. And I think over the course of the Middle Ages, we saw a shift from sort of the dominant mode of life, the dominant lifestyle being a rural one, an agricultural one, where people worked for subsistence, so they worked to make the things they needed to survive, pay taxes to their lord, or tithes, but, like, they could pay all of that in, like, apples or whatever, or hogs.
Yeah,
like,
they're
just paying your lord in lard. And having a very generalist skill set that you need in order to, you know, turn a large amount of land into a living. And especially over the course of the Middle Ages, and in particular when populations were completely decimated by the Black Plague. By the end of the 15th century, like, the average, okay, a lot of people were still obviously agricultural workers.
The vast majority.
But there was a much greater presence of a more urban lifestyle where you had a lot less land, of course, a lot less space. You weren't working for subsistence. You were doing something more specialized to earn money as part of a urban ecosystem of work. And I think that, unfortunately, like, that, the latter sort of lifestyle was seen in general as antithetical to, like, what a woman should be up to, and antithetical to, like, the feminine virtue of, like, staying at home and laboring for your family, you know, to create things for them, to keep them fed and clothed. Like, the professional lifestyle was basically everything that a woman should not be. And so these professional spaces, you know, again, were seen as spaces that were antithetical to femininity. It was seen almost like, you know, having women in these spaces would taint them and also taint the woman. Or perhaps the woman is tainted if she wants to go into a male space in the first place.
We are in danger. Quail and our fathers.
So, to summarize the points made so far, demand for luxury textiles created a self-sustaining feedback loop that increased urbanization, increased the professionalization of textile manufacturing.
All right.
Correct?
Yes. Yes, I would very much say so. And furthermore, this happened despite this artistic and cultural history of depicting the textile arts as being the domain of the woman, in particular as the demand for textiles rose. So too did the demand for new technologies and for new ways of automating these processes, which then further excluded women from the actual professionalization of the process. And although, of course, we can't categorically say men did this and women did this and there was absolutely no crossover, I think what I really do want to drive home is about the difference between this ideal of course, textiles are things that women do at home in their womanly way, and the reality of the situation, which was that in a world that was rapidly developing a taste for more and more and more things, and wealth and luxury and goods and consumption and information, something like textiles that requires this absolutely massive investment of human capital and human labor, like, anything will go. That and the urge, you know, the need for profit and the need to keep making and producing will always, I think, overtake the you know, the need to conform to social order.
In many ways, you might say, and this is pure speculation on my part, because I don't think there's enough, I just don't think there's enough in the source record to say confidently either way, that the endurance of this idea of textile manufacturing being women's work is a kind of, you could see it as a kind of trad rev turn, like, you know, anxiety about the sort of the way that society was changing. And it's like, it's extra important that the women stay at home and do textiles because society is getting weird in ways that I don't like.
Yeah. Yes, I think absolutely. And
like, they invented cottagecore as an aesthetic 1,000 years early.
No, definitely, definitely. Especially because, like, women absolutely were still spinning later on in the Middle Ages, but they were increasingly likely to be doing it for a pittance wage, mm-hmm. for a very small amount of money, because spinning and carding, so the earliest stages of the process, they require the largest amount of time and therefore have always been the worst paid, mm-hmm. and have always been without guild representation. They've always just been like a big free-for-all kind of piecework gig economy. Just get as much as you can.
And in the sort of male-dominated professional spaces of the urban world, that tension manifested in things like the revolt of the Ciompi in Florence. In places where that kind of work was done by women in rural areas, which was possible because things like accountancy was getting better, so it was possible to send a guy around to pick up the wool and pay him to do it. Women didn't... The thing that made the revolt of the Ciompi possible was the existence of a pre-existing state structure that said, you are a worker, you are entitled to rights on the basis of your occupation, and that just happened to not be extended.
Yeah.
The intellectual framework was there, and then it allowed the chumpy, the men of the chumpy, to challenge it and say, you know, okay, so why not us? Women didn't have a framework. There was no framework that even had a door ajar for women to make those kinds of claims.
Yeah.
And so you don't there. That's why there. What I'm trying to get at here is that, like, that was shit for women, and I'm sure they knew it, but they couldn't do much about it.
Yeah. And I think an interesting dichotomy. I think that technological innovation always brings out, like, interesting facets of labor dynamics as well. I think one of my favorite anecdotes from textile history, although of course there are many and it would be hard to choose just one, is the fact that quite a few different automations and technological advancements in the textile fields were not really used widely at the time of their invention. So, for instance, an automated knitting machine was invented in Elizabethan England, and Queen Elizabeth ordered it to be destroyed because it would put all of the hand knitters out of work, and the guild would get up in arms and they would hate that. And so I think that's also the flip side of this sort of male professionalism worlds. Whereas one of the biggest medieval textile innovations was the spinning wheel, not just for the improved efficiency that it offered, but also because it is a symbol of industrialization and professionalism, I would say, to an extent. Because rural women were not adopting the spinning wheel. Like, it was not useful to them because you can't take it with you. And if you're going to milk the cows or go to market,
or just hang out with your shitty kid,
or hang out with your stupid kid, or with, like, the other, you know, spinsters from the village, then you have your spindle and your distaff, so your big fiber-holding rod with you. And that's how women are portrayed in the Middle Ages, in medieval manuscripts. They have their spindle and their distaff, and they go about their merry way. Wherever they go, they take it with them. And the spinning wheel is much more effective, much more efficient than the spindle. But that only pays off if you can sit down and use it, like, all day. And so it was...
You can make it a full-time job.
Yeah, exactly. And even then, spinning was not particularly well paid, but it offered this massive improvement to efficiency to fuel this trade in textiles as a commodity. So the spinning wheel was introduced into Europe from redacted. Many countries claim to be the home of the spinning wheel. Who knows, but probably sometime in the mid-12th century. And interestingly, the spinning wheel, although it did take a while to become widespread and for there to be a need for this improved efficiency, the spinning wheel coincided with a few other very crucial technological developments. So around the same time, and interestingly, in many of the same areas that were known for having prolific linen production, paper mills sprung up as well. Paper in the Middle Ages isn't made from wood pulp the way it is today. It's made almost exclusively from linen, sometimes hemp, usually linen. And not just plain old linen rags, old clothes. So paper in the Middle Ages was mostly made, as it was, you know, until basically like the mid-19th century, was basically made entirely from old clothes. Old linen clothing. And so it has been argued, I think you would probably have to do some analysis with data that doesn't exist in order to prove this. But it has been argued that the improved efficiency of spinning was one of the biggest reasons why the paper industry began to flourish.
More clothes.
More clothes, exactly. More clothes for cheap. And unlike previously, where you might have been incentivized to hold on to your clothes and fix them, and patch them as much as possible, you could flip them to the Rag and Bone Man, ye old Rag and Bone Man, you know?
Yeah.
And he would take them, and he would take them down to get made into paper. And it is very, this very specific medieval papermaking guides say you can't use, like, the raw linen. You have to use it after it's, like, been turned into clothes.
Mm. This is what we love of Weird Medieval Guys, everybody. An unfalsifiable hypothesis.
Yes. And, of course, an extension of this hypothesis is the fact that arguably one of the things that the paper industry and the urbanization that corresponded with this massive increase in fabric production led to was the printing press. You can't print without paper. That's not true. You can print on parchment, and they did. But paper is a lot cheaper. And if you're making a whole book,
you need a lot of paper.
Probably going to want to print on paper, because paper is like the spinning wheel to the spindle. Paper is exponentially cheaper than parchment.
And it's also just, does it, well, actually, no, it depends on if it has a longer lifespan.
Paper has a much shorter lifespan. But they didn't know that.
Oh, no, I'm getting confused with papyrus.
Papyrus has a much shorter life.
Papyrus is like 15 minutes.
Papyrus is like 15 minutes. Actually, rag paper, so like linen paper, is like a few hundred years. And then like the shitty acid wood pulp paper that we have is like not that long.
Oh, so I was right. Just a roundabout way. It doesn't give me any credit.
Parchment is like, nothing will last as long as parchment that we know of.
Give me some vellum.
Yeah, no, it's there was a big controversy because, like, they stopped printing the Houses of Lords statutes on vellum.
Yeah.
Which I think is sad, because vellum making is on the endangered crafts list of endangered crafts.
Yeah, well, I think the cows probably feel pretty good about that.
Oh, well. So, yeah, I mean, did the spinning wheel directly lead to the invention of the printing press?
Yes, we're saying yes.
100%.
And you should tell that to all your friends and use this as a source.
Yes, please cite me. Well, yeah, of course, we'll never know for sure, but I would argue that considering how stupidly expensive parchment paper is, like, and how stupidly expensive clothes were, I don't know. I think there's something to it.
Well, I mean, it's a change in, I think it's probably, you know, there's probably too many links in the chain of causality to sort of say for certain that this did happen. But I think it's undeniable to say that, yes, the invention of the printing press is all well and good, but unless you have a cheap supply of cheap paper, the main consequence of the printing press, which is the development of mass literacy and the development of a literate monoculture, is infeasible. It doesn't matter if you have a cool machine that can print stuff down if it costs £1 million per page.
Yeah, exactly. And I think more broadly what we can say is that all of these developments are part of a bigger picture of an increasingly complex, literate, educated, urbanized society that wants things to consume. Hungry mind, you know. Things for your mind, things for your body. I think, like, food doesn't play in here because, like, you know, they were eating, like, shit in medieval London, you know?
Eel pie.
It would be like, God, I miss my farm so much.
I miss my organic veggies.
Exactly. I don't want to eat fish from the Thames anymore. They've been dumping the empty dye, you know, the used up dye vats full of piss.
Mom, are eels meant to be purple?
Exactly.
So, thank you so much for listening to yet another episode.
No.
Oh, wait, what?
You have to say that's just about going to do us.
Yeah, okay, that's right. Sorry,
I'm sorry, but it would be wrong if you didn't.
Well, that's just about going to do us. It started out as just an expression.
I know, but it's like, it would be like trying to go to sleep with your, like, oven on. Trying to finish the Weird Medieval Guys podcast without you uttering that phrase.
Well.
Well.
Well. The thing I say. Olivia, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Weird Medieval or on my personal account at Olivia_MS.
On Twitter.
On Twitter.
And you can find me at Aaron P. Tappers on Twitter or on Blue Sky at just at Aaron.
And you can join the official Weird Medieval Guys Discord.
It's popping off.
It's different to the unofficial one. We don't talk about that one.
The dark Discord. And if you enjoy this episode, then please do a couple of things. Please do give us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. Please do tell a friend, because we don't advertise at all. We do this, you know, because we think it's fun.
This show is like an extended advertisement for hanging out with us.
Don't tell them what the actual business model of podcasting is. The grist in the mill is parasocial relationships.
No, or so I'm saying, like, come to London, hang out with us.
Oh, yeah, do
hit that. Us That'd up. Be cool.
Also, you can leave us a comment on Spotify, like, M. Tutuli, who says, "Who doesn't love a great frame story with a caked up frog? Thank you for this. Sure made this gloomy Sunday more joyful." If you're wondering what episode that is, you need to catch up. I'd also like to address, from the Witches episode, Andrea Garvey, who says, I'm gonna do the voice. "Massachusetts listener here, agreeing that Cranes is the best Gloucester area beach. For the record, I do not agree with that. That is the opinion of Deb Goodwitch. I do not co-sign it. Good Harbor Beach is the GOAT."
Wow.
The parking's terrible, but if you live in Gloucester, that's not a problem. I can make more hyper-regional references.
If we have any listeners from Montana, please shout me out. I'll give you guys references if you want.
No, in the comment, we're going to have a comments war. Sound off in the comments if you're from Massachusetts. Tell me what your favorite item is to buy at Market Basket.
If you're from Montana, tell me what your favorite part of the buffalo is.
Talk about the Mass Pike. Talk about the tea.
Tell me about what gun you shoot bobcats with.
Talk about which one of the 3,000 Central Mass college towns you went to.
If you're from Bozeman, Montana, tell me what the best Sweet Pea Local Arts Festival poster has ever been.
If you're from Gloucester, Massachusetts, tell me about the St. Peter's Day Fiesta and whether or not you've ever done the Greasy Pole.
What? You sicko!
Have I not talked to you about the Greasy Pole?
No, you have. You
okay?
Have.
Okay. I'm just gonna tell my listeners, my beloved listeners, go and search Greasy Pole, Gloucester, Massachusetts, and have yourself a fun day.
Yeah, or just text Aaron to get that. Never mind. Actually,
fuck you. This is all staying in, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I was imagining this, like, fading out while the outro music fades in.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but you have to leave in me saying this should fade out as the outro music fades in, and fade the outro music in, so it's, like, meta.
All right.
Okay.
Take it easy.
Yankees suck.